All hail to the market, said the broker to the boss. It keeps us in our finery, our glitter and our gloss. It allocates resources with an invisible hand. It's remarkable how well it works when none of it is planned. The market is my enemy, the worker did reply. I've felt your market forces like a hurricane sweep by. It shares our wealth and riches, that much I'd say is true. But it takes them from our pockets and it gives them all to you. All hail to the market, the boss man did repeat. You cannot blame the market if you have no food to eat. For it's not the market's function, so your case, it has a flaw. The needs of common people don't come into it at all. The market is a menace, the worker did proclaim. The factory where I used to work is closed in a market's name. And the factory stands empty, the once made things we still need, but now produces nothing but a testament to greed. The boss has seen the market crash, his businesses are through. He does not hail the market in the way he used to do. For he is standing on a window ledge as he begins to weep. And the folk who used to work for him are urging him to leave. You cannot hail the market if you have any sense. We are not part of its equation, it exists at our expense. So my advice to you, my friends, keep fighting for the day when the mass of working people sweep the market far away. So my advice to you, my friends, keep fighting for the day when the mass of working people sweep the market far away.
Thank you.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. You can listen to this program and other wonderful programs at 96.5 FM in the Sacramento area. And today's program, if you're just tuning in, is America's Path to Permanent War. Andrew Bacevich, an international relations professor at Boston University, says now is the time to examine the Washington consensus on national security. He argues that national priorities must shift from fixing Afghanistan to fixing Detroit.
What's that? You hold it? Okay. Edith Everett, one of the big problems on the horizon is Iran these days. What do you suppose is happening in Washington in terms of the discussion of what to do, if to do? And by the way, thank you very much for a wonderful presentation.
Thank you. Well, I can say anything I want to say because I have no idea what they're actually talking about and thinking about in Washington. I don't have any kind of inside information. But my guess would be the following. We already have too much war and too few warriors. We really don't need another war. I imagine that President Obama is acutely aware of that, not simply because yet another war wouldn't make a heck of a lot of sense, but also because we're entering the season in which his sensitivity to political, domestic political considerations is going to become more, it will rise to the fore. He's going to have a hard enough time winning a second term with a 9+% unemployment rate and the people who elected him not really all that gung-ho on the fact that we are about to enter the 10th year of the Afghanistan war. So I would think that President Obama would not be enthusiastic about pushing the problem with Iran to the point where there is violence. I imagine that as they think about the Iranian problem, they have to think very seriously about the fact that the government of Israel perceives the problem somewhat differently than we do. I personally do not believe that Iran poses an existential threat to the United States of America. Were I an Israeli Jew, I might have a different view of that. And the history of the State of Israel, which is one where they have seldom shown great patience in the eyes of a brewing security threat, and in which has seen Israel developing very sophisticated military capabilities, certainly means that from a U.S. perspective, the possibility of an Israeli preemptive strike has to be viewed as a live option. I think we have an enormous interest in preventing Israel from doing that. No, I don't mean prevent. We can't prevent them from doing anything. They're going to do what they want to do, of trying to dissuade them from doing that. And frankly, from the Israeli perspective, it's not an easy call, because to start a war with Iran, which could very likely induce an Iranian response that would put U.S. forces at risk in Iraq and Afghanistan, could, from an Israeli perspective, put the Israeli-U.S. relationship in some jeopardy. And from an Israeli perspective, that's bad news. I mean, the government of Israel, I think, already views itself increasingly as isolated and under siege, and anything, therefore, that could undercut the relationship with the United States would be disastrous. So even to the extent that they view the Iranian program as representing an existential threat, that doesn't mean that it's an easy call for them to deal with it. So that's part of the problem. Now, the truth is, of course, we don't know if the Iranians are developing a nuclear weapon, and they deny that they are. I have said that were I the Iranian National Security Advisor, I would favor the development of a nuclear weapon, because from the Iranian perspective, they've got real national security problems, and national security problem number one is the United States of America. And there's plenty, I think there's considerable evidence that you can get in big trouble trying to develop a nuclear weapon, but once you succeed in developing a nuclear weapon, then you get to play by different rules. Then you become like North Korea, you become like Pakistan. So from the Iranian perspective, there's great risk in having a program. There may be considerable payoff if you can pull this thing off. Where am I in the bottom line? The bottom line is, I think that the idea of imposing sanctions on them in order to try to get them to reveal their nuclear program, whether it's benign or not benign, is smart. It may not work. At a minimum, it's a way of trying to persuade the government of Israel that we do take this thing relatively seriously. If 6 months from now or a year from now, the Iranians test a weapon, then it seems to me that what makes sense is for us to implement a strategy of deterrence. Okay, you guys got a nuclear weapon. Use it. It'll be the last thing that happens in Iran. That's the basic posture that we used vis-a-vis the Soviet Union. It's very difficult, I think, at this remove to be able to evaluate entirely clearly the extent to which the strategy of deterrence shaped Soviet behavior or whether Soviet behavior was shaped by other considerations. The strategy of deterrence is based on the assumption of rationality on the part of your adversary. And, of course, there are people who would say that Mr. Ahmadinejad, who was here yesterday, explaining that that we perpetrated the 9/11 attacks, is viewed in some quarters as a total nut job. There's an argument that says that if there's a nuclear button, it's not his finger that's on it. That basic decisions about national security policy are made by the mullahs. My bet is that the mullahs are likely to be rational and therefore deterrable. Again, that's a bet by an American when the United States would not be directly threatened. And I can understand that other countries might view that prospective threat differently. I mean, there's no easy answer here.
Ernest Rubenstein, is it realistic to assume any change in the Washington rules, in particular the projection of American power overseas, so long as the United States is overwhelmingly dependent on oil from troubled areas around the world?
Well, certainly our refusal to have a serious energy policy. Remember, we are old enough to remember Operation Independence, declared by Richard M. Nixon at the time of the first oil shocks. Nixon, who said, This cannot stand. We have to achieve. Every president since then has said, yes, yes. And we still haven't done anything serious about it. It's really a remarkable statement about our politics, that here we are, lo these, what, 40 years later, and we're still arguing about whether or not we ought to deal with this problem. But I don't think that's really sort of the cornerstone of the issue.
Access Sacramento broadcasts great speeches and interviews every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m., or you can get the podcast at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
It was as if there was a contest to see how many holes could be dug, to see how much of it could be sucked from the ground, to kill off every beetle and bug, to kill off every woman and child, and to kill off every man. And they put it all in barrels, and they put the barrels into cans. That's how it was at the end of the age of oil. It was like a competition to see how big everything could get, from the highways to the strip malls to the giant TV sets, from the Moabs to the drag lines, monster trucks and SUVs, and the massive roaring chainsaws that cut down all the trees. That's how it was at the end of the age of oil. It was like they were trying to see how many garbage dumps they could fill, how many flagpoles could they squeeze onto a single windowsill, how many countries could be bombed, how much black gold could they drill, how much coal could they extract if they just blew up all the hills. That's how it was at the end of the age of oil. It was as if there was some kind of test, and the only way to pass was to turn the planet's atmosphere into a cloud of poison gas. It was like the only thing that mattered was the death of life on Earth. That seemed to be the proof that you had made your money's worth. That's how it was at the end of the age of oil. And now here we are, rotting in this bubble, and I'm looking at my grandchildren, framed in by the rubble, wondering what I could have done to avert this fate. But I was too busy playing concerts, saying, isn't life great? That's how it was at the end of the age of oil. That's how it was at the end of the age of oil.
And now, back to Andrew Bacevich and America's Path to Permanent War.
I mean, if the question began, can we do it? Why can't something be done about the Washington rules, or what could cause something to be done about the Washington rules? I think the big problem is that we, most of us, are completely insulated from the consequences of misguided policies. We are insulated in two respects. The first, of course, is that having abandoned the concept of a citizen soldier and opted for our professional army, what the founders would have called a standing army, something that the founders were greatly concerned about, we find ourselves in this condition of essentially permanent war, and the burden of service and sacrifice falls on roughly 1/2 of 1% of the American people. It's not amusing, it's actually quite sad, to listen to a politician in Washington. President Obama himself has done this, say something to the effect that this nation is at war. This nation is not at war. I mean, the United States Army and the United States Marine Corps, supported by the United States Air Force and the United States Navy, those people are at war. But for the great majority of the American people, contact with those people is actually minimal. We support the troops by cheering for the troops. We don't support the troops by insisting that we will share in the sacrifices that they are making in our name. As long as that continues to be the case, then I think that the Washington that helps to sustain the Washington rules. And the second piece is we don't even pay for the wars that are waged in our names. It's all borrowed money. It's astonishing. If you go back and look at the speeches that Franklin Roosevelt made, this is even before Pearl Harbor, but after the declaration of a national emergency and the country was beginning to gear up for whatever the future held, Franklin Roosevelt was quite candid in saying that sacrifice will be required of all of us. They raised taxes. I just read the other day that the highest tax rate during World War II, I think, was 93%. I don't advocate 93%. But the point is, and it's not true that the American people paid for all of the costs of World War II. There was a substantial increase in debt. But the American people sure tried to pay for World War II, the war that was conducted in their name. What we have is tax cuts, and now one of the political issues of the moment, arguing how to render permanent these tax cuts. I mean, I don't care. I mean, the argument that's made by the Democrats, I guess, is if you repeal the tax cuts for the people in the highest income bracket, which, by the way, includes university professors, that you can save $700 billion over the course of 10 years. That's not exactly chump change. But on the other hand, it really doesn't get to the core issue. The core issue is we are living so far beyond our means that it's obscene. But that, too, we don't feel. We don't have a skin in the game. It is not affecting our daily way of life today. I mean, I've argued in print that if you divide up, I think the war costs are in round numbers, this is round numbers now, war costs are about $400 billion a year if you totaled up everything. And if you divide that by the number of tax-paying households, single and joint filers, and if we paid for the war costs, that would, for the average, obviously it would be depending on income level, for the average tax-paying household, our income tax would go up every year by $3,300. Do that, and the American people will recognize that there's a problem here with perpetual war. But, of course, the Congress won't do that. And to tell you the truth, we don't want the Congress to do that. We want to continue to play along with this illusion that somehow there are no financial or fiscal or economic consequences of this level of military activity.
Thank you, sir. When you finish writing books, William Verdone, thank you. When you finish writing books and retire, you should do stand-up comedy. Or perhaps at our age, sit-down comedy. But nevertheless, my question is, with your revised impressions of the Credo and the Trinity, I get the feeling that it is maybe for foreign perception of dampening down American arrogance. I wonder if you can comment on that.
I didn't quite. Could you just say that again in different words? I don't think I understood.
Your revised Credo and Trinity. It seems that it is dampening down foreign perception of American arrogance, where we always seem to be.
Okay. I mean, were Washington to adopt my rules, would one effect be to reduce the perception abroad that we are too full of ourselves? Could be that would be one result. That would not be in particular why I would advocate what I'm advocating. I'd advocate what I'm advocating because I think it's in our best interest. I think there's a huge, well, substantial risk. The assumption in, one assumption that underlies my counterproposal, my new national security consensus, is that the world will learn to adjust. The world will learn to find mechanisms, arrangements that will avoid blowing up the planet without having the United States have a military presence in however many dozen countries. I mean, the assumption is that, invited to do so, Europe can find a way to provide for its own security. And, you know, to be candid, there are some people who say, well, there's plenty of evidence that Europe can't do that. They would say, have you forgotten Bosnia? Remember, that was supposed to be the hour of Europe, and they screwed it up, and they did. I would not take that failure of Europe at that particular juncture as somehow definitive. You know, when I say, for example, and I do say, we should pull out of NATO. Let NATO be a European alliance that exists for the purpose of defending Europe. Let's have NATO not be an alliance that exists for the purpose of pacifying Afghanistan. When I say pull out of NATO, I don't mean pull out of NATO next Tuesday. I mean here in the year 2010, tell them that in the year 2020, the U.S. will withdraw its forces from Europe and will withdraw from the alliance. So you Brits and you Germans and you French people and you Belgiques, you've got a decade to figure it out. And I think told in advance that that reflects our intention and offered time and opportunity to figure out what approach to European defense they would have to take if it's on their own, I think they probably could be counted on to figure that out.
Sandra Stein, thank you so much for a terribly needed voice in the public dialogue. I was thinking when you discussed Iran and Israel, hadn't thought of this before, but if miraculously they somehow make a deal between the Palestinians and Israelis, wouldn't that take away any justification for Iran? Not that they have any, but any supposed justification for Iran to be a threat to Israel?
Yes, but. And I think you actually phrased the question in the correct way. And the issue here is, what is the larger significance of the Israeli-Palestinian dispute? And how should we view it? Obviously, it is a great tragedy for the two peoples that are locked in this perpetual conflict, which costs both sides in different ways, but costs both sides, I think, pretty significantly. My view is that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict matters to us in that for decades now, Arabs, more broadly nations, governments in the Muslim world, have cited the grievances of the Palestinian as the basis for anti-Israeli or anti-Western policies and behavior. And certainly, since the rise of Al-Qaeda, the violent jihadists cite the grievances of the Palestinian as providing some amount of moral justification for this campaign that they are engaged in. I'm not an expert on this, but as much as I've read, I'm not believing that these Arab or Muslim or governments or Al-Qaeda genuinely are motivated by concerns for the Palestinian. It is a convenient pretext. And I think from a U.S. perspective, we do have a profound interest in taking away that moral pretext for their actions. Particularly with respect to Al-Qaeda and similar organizations, what we want to do is to make as clear as possible that there is zero, no conceivable justification for the violence that they wage against the West, with 9/11, of course, as the preeminent example of that. So to settle the Israeli-Palestinian dispute is to strip that away. That doesn't mean that as soon as that happens, were it to happen, that then all the Arab countries and Muslim countries would say, the Americans are our friends. Let's bury the hatchet. We've been brothers for so long. I don't think that for a second. I think that there are all kinds of reasons in which interests are at odds with one another. So the benefit here is a limited but very real benefit of making clear, particularly in the context of terrorism, a moral, it enables us to differentiate in the moral realm. That's what I think. That's why I think it really is exceedingly important for us to try to get that dispute settled, although I'm deeply pessimistic because I think the amount of leverage we actually have to bring to the problem is far less than the more hopeful commentators seem to believe.
Got a revolution. Got a revolution. All you need a reason, all the people. And now for something completely different.